So he says, again, it's an anonymous author. We don't know who it was. We know it was a Carthusian monk. We think it was, but we don't know much more than that. It was written in Old English. Middle English or Old English? Any English scholars? I was reprimanded because there's a very severe difference. What's that? 14th century, I think? Middle. All right. I'll Google it later. So he says this. He said, "A man is humble when he stands in the truth with the knowledge and appreciation for himself as he really is. And actually, anyone who saw and experienced himself as he really and truly is would have no difficulty being humble, for two things would become very clear to him." Okay, so what he's saying there is, if you saw reality directly, I'm putting in the slight Buddhist lingo, right? If you experience reality directly, if you had a direct perception of reality, you would experience two things. Now, if you remember, this is where we left off with the Buddha, right? The Buddha achieved this state of enlightenment, and he saw four basic things. What were they? What was the first thing he realized? Yeah, all life is suffering. What's the second thing? Yeah, that there is a cause for suffering, which is a nice second thing to follow it up with, you know? Because if you just said all life is suffering and, you know, that's all we can say about it, there's not much hope for us. But if you can say then there is a cause to suffering, right? What's the third thing? There is an end. And that's it's so simple that we miss it. Because we have to ask ourselves, who here really believes that there is an end to suffering? And when you look, I feel that when you look deeply in Scripture, they're not saying, whether it's Christian or Hindu or Muslim or Buddhist, they're not saying there isn't an end in the afterlife. Over and over, it's there is an end here in this present life. It's possible for you to get to a place where you no longer suffer. And then what's the fourth thing the Buddha realized? Yeah, that there is a path to the end of suffering. There is a step-by-step way of getting there. And these models of awakening are simply those step-by-step ways. So, interestingly enough, the author of The Cloud just basically saying, if you could actually experience yourself as you truly are, I mean, what does that mean? I don't even know, right? Because I only experience myself through these, almost through these filters of, like, obscure filters. These diluted filters are the only way I can experience myself. But he's saying, what if in your spiritual practice you had a glimpse of experiencing yourself as you truly are? A direct perception of the reality. He says, you would realize two things. It's interesting. I mean, sometimes I notice my mind just reads through scriptures and I miss some of these gems, right? Because you miss the implications in these. Sit with it. In the Benedictine monastery, we read everything three times and we read it slowly. And it's a very beautiful practice. Because when you read something, the first time your mind just is kind of getting a general sense of it. The second time you can slow down and start to hear things. And then the third time, the implications become apparent. It's a beautiful practice. Try it. As opposed to just reading and reading, just take a line and just read it three times and then sit with it. So, what are the two things? He says this. In the first place, he would see clearly the degradation, misery, and weakness of the human condition. It sounds a little bit what the Buddha saw, right? He would see clearly the reality that we're miserable. And we've talked about this. Particularly the image that always comes up for me is seeing a mother talk to her meth addicted son, right? And she's saying, just come home, like I'll take care of you, like you can get out of this. And he said, Mom, would you leave me alone? I'm happy, right? Because in his, and he's pockmarked, you know, he's homeless, he smells bad, and in his mind, he was content. Right? But his mother is seeing something different. She's like, no, you're not happy. It's a funny thing to try to convince somebody they're not happy, right? I mean, usually we're trying to do the other thing, like everything will be okay, you know. But in a sense, and that's the same thing that the enlightened beings see when they see us. And we're like, no, leave me alone. Everything's good. I'm happy. Until what a great teacher Lama Mu calls pop-ups in horror land. Right? You know how you go in the little carousel rides and like something pops up to scare you? And you know, he says our lives are just kind of that until those pop-ups. Until cancer or loss of somebody close to us or the loss of a job. I stayed with a man in Brazil who made... who is the leading producer of silicone for silicone breasts. And he was a huge, huge millionaire. In fact, he built a whole separate building, five-story building for his kids, so he wouldn't have to hear them party. So we stayed in the kids' building because it's just more fun. And they partied, you know. But he was telling me, and this was a man that was quite used to wealth, he was telling me, and I don't know the history of Brazil so much, but that one day the government froze all the bank accounts. And he woke up with only the money that was in his pocket. He went from incredible wealth to only the money he happened to not have in the bank that day. That's like a pop-up in horror land, you know? So most of us don't realize, and we've gone through the three different types of suffering that the Buddha showed us, but most of us don't realize the suffering. And we don't want to think about it. We cover it up until the pop-up in horror land, and then we realize. And then you notice how it goes the opposite. My whole life is meaningless. When the pop-up really hits, suddenly everything is like dark and dismal. There is no beauty, you know. So the first thing he says is that you would see clearly the degradation, misery, and weakness of the human condition. And then the second thing he says, in the second place, he would recognize the transcendent goodness of God as he is in himself and his overflowing, superabundant love for man. That there is almost this duality, right? There is this notion that all life is suffering, but underneath that there is also something exquisitely beautiful. And it's the same thing the Buddha discovered. Right? That there is some way out. There is a path out. And St. Teresa says the same thing. And then he says, before such goodness and love, nature trembles. Sages stammer like fools, and the saints and angels are blinded with glory. So overwhelming is this revelation of God's nature that if his power did not sustain them, I dare think what might happen. So here we have something interesting. We have this idea that there is a beauty that is so exquisite that it would make us stammer, right? And in fact, it would scare us. And I heard somebody talking one time about this idea that about angels, and it got me thinking. And what's the first thing in the Bible that people say when they see an angel? Or what's the first thing the angel says?
Fear.
Fear not. Did you ever think about why? Okay? Why would you personally tell somebody not to fear not? What would they look like in front of you? They would look really scared, right? You'd be like, don't worry, it's just me, you know? Even when you come to the kitchen and the person is like starting, like, it's just me, right? So it's not that angels are beautiful. It's not that they're lovely. They're absolutely terrifying. It's a different notion of angels. Because the exquisiteness of the divine reality is more than our minds can handle. And again, you see this over and over in Scripture. Check out, what is it, the 18th chapter, I think, of the Bhagavad Gita, where Arjuna, this devotee of God, is telling God, please let me see your real nature. Right? And then God, in the form of Krishna, says, okay, you asked for it, you know. And then what does Arjuna say? He says, never mind, I've seen enough. Go back to how you were, you know. Because it's terrifying. There's some exquisiteness that's beyond our minds to comprehend. Which means that anything that we say it is, at this point, is not it. Okay? Do you see what I'm doing? Anything that we say is ultimate reality at this point is in fact not ultimate reality. It's just pointing in that direction. And this moves us a little bit into the fundamentalist dilemma. You see, I'm so attracted to fundamentalists because of their passion and their belief You know, I lived in the South for a while, and you go in the Southern Pentecostal church, and this is not a dry place. You know, it's a, there's people that believe in the truth of religion. They're not just, you know, remember in the Cloud of Unknowing, he says the four stages, right? What's the first stage there? The common. Did I write anything next to it?
Yeah, common manner of the Christian life and a day-to-day mundane existence
with your friends. Yeah, a day-to-day mundane existence with your friends. Okay? For many Christians, for many religious people, that's what the religious life is. It's a successful social institution. And it's successful. It provides all kinds of comfort. It provides community. It provides welfare to the less needy. But it does not push, oftentimes, members into deep experiences of salvation and liberation, which is what Christ intended to do. I am so glad, personally, that I was not around Christ when he was alive, because I think it would have been intensely uncomfortable. You know, we think, like, God, it would have been so neat to have met him. Imagine, I mean, he's so, like, blasphemous. Imagine he didn't say, like, come follow me when you, you know, when you tell your family goodbye and, you know, make sure everything's taken care of. He said, no, come with me now or don't come with me at all, right? He said, drop your nets and just come with me now. That's intense, right? He did not preach the secret. You see what I mean? He did not preach how to be comfortable. He really, what he did was make the lives of the people around him highly uncomfortable. And you can see that. And think about the lives of the apostles. They were always struggling with, is this guy crazy? I mean, they must have been, right? Because we as humanity, up to a certain level, it's very interesting. It's called in Buddhism the path of seeing. Up to a certain level, we are fraught with doubt. We have doubt. And Christ's disciples must have had doubt. I mean, everybody around him was saying, this guy's crazy. He's just lost, you know. I mean, here he is, like, hanging out with women, letting them massage him. You know, he's telling you to leave your family and to just follow him. And he's saying that he's, like, the Messiah. I mean, it's madness, right? But what he's proposing is a model of liberation that's not easy. It's not a day-to-day mundane life with your friends. It's a very radical model. And, you know, maybe one that we don't want to take, but it's one that's interesting to look at and consider from that perspective.